Good evening. So, tonight's scheduled speaker was a monk from Land of Medicine Buddha, and you've probably heard she called in sick, and we're hoping she can speak next week.
She's scheduled for 2 weeks from now.
Okay, so she'll be here for 2 weeks. And so I'll be the understudy tonight, playing the role of the Tibetan nun will be the Reverend Patrick Tiverbaugh. I've been practicing my lines for 24 years. And tonight is the big night. So I was scheduled to give a talk next week, so I already was percolating a few ideas. And so we'll see if they come together as a talk. Also, what I told Kokyo is that I've just come back from vacation, so I've got plenty of stories to tell. I can fill up a few minutes with just my stories, and I will. I think vacation is. You know, we make everything bigger. We see a bigger world. A lot of the times we go places that we haven't been to, and I did. I went to Scotland, so the world looks bigger. I've certainly taken a lot of stay-at-home vacations in my life, staycations, but even then, time is bigger. So vacation for me. Feels like a bigger perspective on the world. I took a lot of pictures on my hiking trip in Scotland, which was beautiful, and I noticed at some point I was taking these big vistas. You know, I wasn't taking little, you know, flowers that I hadn't seen before, or little pieces of pottery that were different than the pottery that I've seen. I was taking big vistas. So I said to myself then, yeah, yes, I am sort of in this space of seeing what the big picture is in the world. I spent a few days in London and then a good long time in Glasgow, Scotland. And I was gonna bring it. I watched this program on Glasgow TV. They had a cooking competition for making porridge, which is oatmeal, and people were competing for this great Scottish prize of the best porridge. And they all had this stick that they were stirring with. Do you know what that stick is called? To get the lumps out of your porridge, which is oatmeal. It's always oats. Scotland says that it invented oats and oatmeal. But the stirring stick looks just like a dowel. It's just a straight stick. It's called a spurtle. And everybody had their spurtle. At the hotel, as a matter of fact, I told you it's all just going to be about my vacation. At the hotel, if you want the breakfast, it was a complimentary breakfast because you paid them a lot of money to stay there, and it came with breakfast, which is very nice. And but if you wanted porridge, you had to tell them the night before. So they take their porridge very seriously. It takes days to make, as far as I can tell. I did other things in Glasgow besides watch TV, but I thought I really love British TV, and all the mystery shows and detective shows, and I thought I was going to be able to sort of watch that, but actually there wasn't much of that. I couldn't find the right station, and they seemed to show a lot of old American sitcoms, and but I did enjoy a few episodes. This was just one night when I was sort of tired of going to museums. I Glasgow's a wonderful town for museums and restaurants, and so I got home a little early and I was beat, so I put on the TV and watched the porridge competition, as well as a few episodes of Golden Girls, which was a favorite of mine in the 80s. You know, four retired people living together, four retired women living together, and now I'm a retired person, so it even had more to do with me. But that was Glasgow. They had a Shakespeare festival in the Botanical Gardens of Glasgow, which is like Golden Gate Park, and I saw Macbeth. And Macbeth is. Maybe I was just in the space that, everything seemed like, Glasgow was a Buddhist town and Macbeth was a Buddhist play. He starts off talking about the hurly-burly of daily life. And in the beginning, he and his, Macduff, have just conquered together, along with many this is where it stops being a Buddhist play, because it's about war, but they all work together, and they think that Macbeth did a great job, and they make him, the king makes him the thane of Cawdor and Glamis, both of them. He gets two big pieces of land, and he's really happy with that. And everybody's there together, all the soldiers and Macduff and Douglas, and the king actually comes over to be able to give him this decree that he's now the thane of these two new places, and he says that this is a wonderful thing, this acknowledgement of his prowess is an ornament to his life. And he said that, he really meant that it made him proud that he did this. But of course, the ornament is this thing that we stick on our clothes, that we stick on the very surface. And that's not usually why we go into spiritual practice. And I've made a big leap here. Macbeth said nothing about going into spiritual practice, last week Shoho says that one of her teachers says that suffering comes about when you start getting into politics, the politics of our life, whether we're promoted at work, whether we've fulfilled all of our dreams. When we start getting into that realm, Shoho says that's suffering. And though Macbeth was a team player at that point in the play, he was already feeling like he was separating himself out, that he was putting value on, this is what I am now, the thane of Cawdor and Glamis. And it's more than I was yesterday. You know, this is the politics of our life. So he was already playing politics. And then the next scene starts the horror, you know, when the king is staying overnight so they could do a big ceremony in the morning to celebrate this. But Macbeth and his wife start thinking, you know, we're just one step away from having the whole thing, not just Cawdor and Glamis. We can have the whole of Scotland, because the king of Scotland is in our house, and we just get rid of him, and then we're next in line. And that's really when the politics start happening. And so he's really separated himself out from the Sangha. Or he's looked at the world and said, this is better than that. And I want what I think is the best. And then suffering ensues. He really, at some point, after several murders, his conscience takes over, and he kind of wishes that he hadn't have separated himself. But he realizes that, I mean, he doesn't realize, he says to himself, but he's already gone too far. He feels like he can't go back. That's not what we really believe in either. There's lots of villains in the Buddhist literature that they just remember the wholeness of their lives, and at that point they're relieved from suffering. But Macbeth felt that he couldn't go back, and continued to be further isolated. He even consults a spiritualist, a fortune teller. So he really tries to be connected to have a deeper connection with the whole universe by consulting this spiritualist, this seer, who says that, you know, he's only going to be killed by, what is it, someone who is not born of woman. And of course that, he says, is not possible, but then Macduff reveals to him in their sword fight that, as a matter of fact, Macduff was born from cesarean section. Mm-hmm. So technically, he wasn't born from woman. You have to go out on a limb a little bit. And of course, and then I got, because I was thinking it was a Buddhist play, then I was trying to do something with the unborn and emptiness that somehow, the emptiness pervades everything. But I was really quite moved by this small little production out in a field in the middle of the park. Only five players, and I looked at it from a point of picking and choosing, or this is better than that, and that's where our suffering begins. Then I went a few days later for the main reason I went to Scotland was this hiking trip around this small island off the west coast of Scotland. And I was reading about this trip, and it said that I was going to pass. I went to the island of, I'll think of it. It was about the size of Santa Cruz County, and not too far. It was easy to get to from Glasgow, just about an hour train ride to the coast and then another hour on the ferry. So it wasn't too hard to get to. It was about the size of Santa Cruz County, shaped like a big kidney bean, north and south, going north and south. This big kidney bean. And it said on this tour that on the third day of the hike, I should take a side trip. I should take a side trip, another ferry boat, to a tiny little island that called Holy Island, which sits kind of right in the little belly of the kidney bean. And it's about, it's very small, just like 4 miles long by 2 miles wide. It takes about you could hike more. But I had some time. It takes about 4 hours to hike around this island. And it said, in addition to the hiking, there's also a Buddhist retreat center there. So that seemed right up my alley, and I had some time, so I actually went online when I was in Glasgow and got myself 3 nights and 4 days at this Buddhist retreat center. It was a little Tibetan tasahara. It had a Tibetan leaning, and it was started in 1992, and it is run by there's a monastery, a Tibetan monastery in the middle of England who kind of ran it, and then during the summer, just like tasahara, from April to October, they have these retreats there. You can go there for 5 days where there's a yoga retreat or a precepts retreat or a mindfulness retreat. You know, these 5 day, and I just happened to be there when there was no big retreat. So there was just the students there, and they looked just like, if you've been to Tassajara, they look just like the students at Tassajara. You know, kind of young college kids, you know, kind of scruffy, and they'd been there for many months. And they were working in the kitchen, you know, kind of cooking my meals. They were in the garden. They had two big gardens there that most of the vegetables came from. And you know, then there was a cabin crew that cleaned the rooms for the paying guests like me and the retreatants that would have been there for their, like, mindfulness, 5 days of mindfulness retreat. But so it looked just like Tassajara. It was a little smaller. And that the retreat house and the gardens and, you know, the dock that had the little ferry that came over was all at one end of the island. And at the other end of the island, 4 miles away, were the monks. And, you know, there's a Tibetan tradition that the monks do a 3-year retreat. And so there were 6 monks at that end of the island doing a 3-year retreat. And then there were 2 more monks that were living isolated by themselves in 2 little cabins. They were doing a lifelong retreat. And also there was a place there where the abbot of the monastery in England that ran the place would come when he would be there. And that compound, I mean, the 2 little cabins with the lifelong monks, they were really separated out. They were up against the hill. But then down the hill was this compound where the other 6 monks were doing their 3-year retreat, and then a place where the abbot could stay. And you could walk by, like I walked, I did 2 trips. I was there 2 full days. So I walked that 4-hour journey around the island both days. It was beautiful. Actually, there's one big hill that you go over to, one mountain. I want to call it a mountain because it wore me out. So you could get close. You could see this, you know, where the monks were, but you just couldn't go, you know, knock on the door and say, yeah, could I use the bathroom? And I didn't see any of the monks out, but beautiful place, this beautiful place. And they did meditation there twice a day. At the retreat center, not at the where the monks were. They were doing meditation all day long. But up at the north end of the island where the retreat center, where my house was, there was meditation twice a day and also chanting twice a day, two other periods of hour-long chanting. And I was really looking forward to, a little different tradition, maybe they sit a little different. I was looking forward to chanting, with the group twice a day. But actually it was real different. Like the first meditation period, when I first got there, I thought I was in the wrong place because I was the only one in there. In this beautiful little zendo, it was on top of another building. Below was there, it was like, their library, their community room. And you could buy tea there, you could give a donation, and there was somebody there, one of the students was kind of serving tea all day long, and you could put a few pence in there and for the tea, but it was above, and it had just as many seats as we did, but it was really narrow. There was just like just a little walkway in between, and then at the end was this beautiful altar, with lots of statues and draperies and fabrics, and so it was really, really beautiful. And I thought maybe I was in the wrong place because I was the only one in there, but I didn't know where else to go, so I just sat down, and I sat for the regular period. I took my watch off and sat, and it turned out that. There was just a couple of people there meditating at each time. So these young students, maybe it was their time. I didn't really ask. So I'm not gonna disparage their practice because maybe it was, between these retreats, maybe it's not part of what they do. And they're there for 6 months after all, from April to October. So I'm not going to disparage them, but from my point of view, I really wanted to sit with somebody else, in a different tradition. Oh, and then the first time I went chanting, there was only one other person there. And it was a different kind of chanting. You really couldn't just drop in. Our chanting is just one note and you pick up the chant book and you read the words or the syllables and, anybody can follow along. Japanese Zen chanting, but Tibetan chanting, for an hour they must have done 20 different chants, and they're all different melodies, and they pick up a chant book that's literally this big, and nobody told me where they started, so I couldn't tell because it was all in Tibetan, with English, English letters, so it was nice listening, but to this one person chant. And then I tried it again the next morning, the chanting, and there were four people in there, and still I would have ruined it for them if I would have started chanting because every tune is different. So I didn't go to the chanting after the two, but I kept sitting, and there was a small group, two or three of us that were sitting most periods. Twice a day, so and it was beautiful. The one time I was the doan because nobody was, I think the time before there was no kind of staff person there ringing the bell, and so all of us that were in there, the three of us that were in there, were all watching our watches, and so I figured, well, here we are doing this again. I might as well just volunteer to ring the bell, and so I did that. And it really did feel like a personal retreat. I mean, they were sitting, and then these hikes. I was largely by myself. These hikes, and it was, this island was named after. It was called Holy Island, and it not just because the Tibetans were there since 1992, It had been called Holy Island since the 7th century, when this Scottish Catholic monk lived in a cave there for 10 years. He was a young monk then. His name was Molache. Lash, according to the guidebook, means flame in Celtic, or you know, we say Gaelic, but on Scotland they say Gaelic. So Lash means flame, and Molache. Mo means little flame. He was there for 10 years in a cave, and you could go to this cave. I was thinking, could I live in this cage for 10 years? Could I live off sort of the berries and the foliage? You know, it was pretty wet there. It was wet in the cave, although, you know, you were really out of... So I really thought that was quite a deal to live in this cave that I saw. There's plenty of water there. It rains all the time, so there were creeks and there was plenty of water. I mean, it was the middle of the summer and it rained every day. beautiful rain. So it has this history of, you know, of a contemplative place that the, and then it was a farm for several centuries. And then the farmer died, you know, after 7 centuries. And then it was sold to the Tibetans for, and it really was this contemplative place. So Molache was there for 10 years. He then went to Rome and came back as kind of a bishop. This island was part of Scotland and Ireland. Ireland had territory of a lot of these western islands that are now Scottish. So Molache became a bishop of this area, and then he became a saint. He's considered the second most well-known saint after Patrick, Saint Patrick. And so he's a saint in both Ireland and Scotland. And so quite a tradition of contemplation on this holy island. And you know, I was aware that I was feeling pretty good about me being one of the few meditators, and those young students can't hold a candle to me. Yeah. They're not even in there. You know, I brought my rakusu, you know, on this trip. So I wore my rakusu. You know, I was walking through the property with my rakusu on. You know, so they knew I was going to go to meditate. And then I sort of thought, okay, but then just a few miles away at the other end of the island, there's people there for 3 years. What's, you know, that trumps me. and then people there for a lifetime, you know, in these little huts. And then, you know, then Molache, you know, in this damp, wet cave for 10 years. So, you know, I felt a lot like Macbeth, you know, putting... You know, what's better than what? Or this is different than that? And am I putting, you know, a value on practice? Is there a right way to practice? I was climbing this big peak on the island. The big island, by the way, it just left me. Aran, thank you. Aran was the big island. I was on this little sesame seed of an island called a Holy Island. So I was going up Mormalash, which means the peak of the island of, you know, named after Molashe, Mormalash. Quite a journey, quite a hike. You know, you could take that ferry and just for the day, just like you can go to Tassajara for the day. You can go to this island and you can hike. And I was hiking, and a lot of retired people hike. And I'm a retired person. And so this retired couple got off the ferry, and we talked a little bit. They both had walking sticks. We talked a little bit, and I sat down, and they just vanished up to Mormalash. They were hikers. They passed me by. Then there was this whole, you know, I walk a little bit more. I was in no hurry. I was going to be there all day. I was going to be there for 4 days. I wanted to get back to sleep. Then this whole group of people, you know, they came. They passed me by. It was like Macduff's army. You know, they passed me by. More people. The Golden Girls passed me up. I was in no hurry, and I'm not in great shape, but I knew I could make it up. You can see it. I knew I could make it up. You know, and then it was, there were lots of people going up Mormalash on Holy Island. But there was plenty of time that I was there, you know, that I was mainly hiking by myself, and I got to thinking about my mind that was discriminating. I mean, how do you make a decision to meditate your whole life in a little hut on a rainy island in Scotland? I don't think you make a decision like that. I mean, do any of us? I mean, we think we made decisions about that's why we got here. We think we made a decision that, oh, I've heard about Santa Cruz Zen Center. Maybe I'll go to Zazen instruction. Maybe I'll go there. We think we make that decision. We think we make a decision to have the job that we've been working at, or the mates that we choose to couple up with. But I just don't know whether we really make a decision. I mean, where does that start? You know, where did you start getting interested in meditation? Nobody meditated, you know, in San Luis Obispo growing up in the 50s. You know, where did I first learn about it? Nobody makes a decision to meditate on this hillside, much less make a decision really to come sit here at Santa Cruz Zen Center. It made me think of that, that concept of the wind bell. It's a poem. It's a poem by Dogen's teacher. You know, so we've us people. I mean, why did we come here? Why didn't we go the other way on Mission Street and go to the Vipassana Center? You know, it's just, you know, two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And, you know, some of us turned right and ended up here, and some of us turned left and ended up at Vipassana Center. How is this a decision? NPR, all I do is listen to NPR. I should meditate more instead of listening to NPR. we're coming on a 9/11 anniversary, and they were interviewing a survivor of the Twin Towers, and he just said, you know, I just ran out, and there was a door open, and I took that door. You know, He said he's not wrestling with why he survived, but he just said, you know, it was clear there was just this open door. It was all I could do. I just went through that door, and it happened to be going downstairs, and he just kept going downstairs. So you know, what kind of decisions do we make in our life? And so Rujing wrote a poem that Dogen passed on to us. Rujing was Dogen's teacher in China. The whole body is like a mouth hanging in empty space. This is the image of the wind bell. That's just this, I think of it as like a cowbell, you know, just this hollow thing, not much there. It's mainly space itself, but it's hanging in empty space. The whole body is like a mouth hanging in empty space, not questioning the winds from east, west, south, or north. Equally with all of them, speaking of prajna, wisdom. So all of these winds from every direction, from any direction, not every, just any direction, is just wisdom, is just prajna. Not questioning the winds from east, west, south, or north, equally with all of them, speaking of prajna, ding dong a ling, ding dong a ling. That was Rujing's poem about our lives. We think we make a decision to do this or that, but as Kokyo said just a few weeks ago, what we are is just the manifestation of the great awareness, that ultimate awareness that's not bigger or better or hotter or colder, like Rujing says, you know, it's not the westerly awareness or the northerly awareness that is blowing us this way and that in our lives. It's just wisdom. It's just awareness. In our Sunday class, a piece by Vasubandhu says, it's just centerlessness and infinite. That's what our lives as windbells are. Hanging, if we think we've got any form at all, we barely have any form. We're mainly empty ourselves. And Vasubandhu might say, yes, we are. There isn't even the windbell. But for the sake of any image at all, you know, the sound that we're making right now, this sound, or the sound of the chair, or the sound of the weaving back and forth, is just that empty, centerless, infinite awareness. And it blew that guy in the Twin Towers right down the hole, out of danger. It blew me to the top of Mor Milosh. It blew those two monks to the side of the hill. It blew those young students that were making my dinner. They were just, you know, there on the windy Mor Milosh. All of us were feeling that same wind. There was nothing but that same wind for all of us there and for all of us here. Not questioning where the wind is from, east, west, south, or north, equally, all is prajna.
Question. And then we think about, I think about this awareness that somehow we, like my thought, come out of, and my thought is, it probably doesn't make choices either.
Say that again. What isn't making choices? No, it's not about choice. It's not.
In other words, we didn't decide to come here, and I don't know that awareness decided to put us here or did anything else either. You know, that it's just same as us.
What did help me out, Nettie and Kokyo, in our Nagarjuna book? You know, when you've got just an inkling of that centerlessness or infinite, he calls us, it's like being a rank beginner.
Partial analysis, or even
less than partial. Something like beginning analysis, but analysis is right. It's just when we first get that inkling, like I'd like to try out. Meditation. I wonder when they start, what time it starts. And also when we were reading that book, it also made us, you know, some of us, you know, have been analyzing for a couple of decades now. It even made us feel like, oh, we're just now tasting that partial analysis as well. Just so that we don't feel, you know, too good about ourselves. But it was a nice feeling to kind of drop that, idea of choice, and that all of our actions, whether it's chopping the vegetables or climbing the mountain or meditating in the cave for 10 years, that this is all the same expression of this awareness, this ultimate being that we might call Buddha, that we might call centerlessness or the infinite, where there's no bigger or smaller or better or worse. And of course, in case we forget, Rujing's poem, who could forget that? The whole body is like a mouth hanging in empty space. Expressing wisdom. That's my new translation. The wisdom of reality. In case we forget that, we get a chance, you know, every week when we chant Dogen's Jiju Yu Samai. Hundreds of things all manifest original practice from the original face. Yeah, Patrick, remember chopping vegetables, sitting in the cave, coming here on Wednesday nights. These are all manifestations of the original practice and the original face. Hundreds of things manifest the original practice from the original face. It's impossible to measure. We can't measure what practice is better than another. It's impossible to measure. Know that if all the Buddhas in every direction, as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, exert their strength and with their wisdom, with their Buddha wisdom, try to measure all of these different practices that we can do. If all the Buddhas try to measure the merit of anybody's practice, of one person's zazen, they will not be able to fully comprehend it. That's Dogen's look at, you know, of what, how do we measure this practice? Is our practice any better now than it was when we first said, I wonder what meditation is all about? I heard they meditate at Santa Cruz Zen Center. Is our practice any different? Is our heart any different? Is the bell making a different sound now than it did then? Rujing said, it's all infinite. It's all centerlessness. Dogen says, it's all a manifestation of our original face. So we have time for a couple of questions. Anybody want to share their vacation plans?
And you go somewhere like that, I just wonder, what was your impression? Did the people seem different? In Scotland, as opposed to walking around Santa Cruz?
No. And like I say, even the Tibetan Tathagata was just like Zen Tathagata. And well, they were chanting in Tibetan, so it's hard to know. Maybe they were putting on it was all done in Scottish. Netty. Thank you. No, it's a great poem, and it really was one of those aha moments being aware that I was quite moved by Macbeth, and then I was having Macbeth's very mind up there on Mormelash. Yeah. Lori.
Well, I just got back from, it wasn't really a vacation, but San Diego. And there wasn't a wind there, but there's a nice breeze. And it blew me. I had intended to go to the San Diego Zen Center, but it was not convenient to get there. But I was out on a walk, and I ended up at a Carmelite monastery. Carmelite nuns, and they sit in seclusion behind a grill. Nobody sees them. They don't see the outside world. Nobody sees them except maybe a visitor come and see them on Sunday right after Mass for a few minutes. So that's like their world, very, very small. And, but I was interested to be there because there were some things about it all that just reminded me how similar Catholic contemplative practice and Zen contemplative practice are, and including going to Mass, and the priest gave this sermon on, well, he called it detachment, which really non-attachment. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he talked about that and the Carmelite charism, and it was such a Buddhist sermon. I mean, really, it was absolutely amazing. They dovetailed. thought how I wanted to bring, you know, Cookie or somebody there to hear that how my thing were that it was the same. It's the same practice.
Yeah.
You know, really, and the things that we need to be doing are the same practice. Just, you know, keeping my, it's the things I need to be reminded of were there.
Yeah.
It was, I happened on it. I was out for a walk in the morning, and I get there and I look and I think, what is this place? It looks like monastery. And sure enough, I didn't, I sort of knew there was a monastery somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
It sort of blew me there.
Yep.
It just blew me there.
Yep.
There it was. The night was there actually several times.
And did your interest in the unity of all things make you more open to your sitting practice, or did your sitting practice make you hear the unity of all things in that mass the other day? You know, who can tell which way that wind bell
that
the door was?
Yeah.
Just an interesting story is, you know, right down in Monterey County is Monastery Beach, which is named that because there's cloistered nuns in their monastery.
That's Carmelites too.
Yeah.
That's
so they're in there, and then next to it is a retreat center because the Monterey Zen Center does their sesshins at that retreat center next to it, and it's staffed by three or four nuns from a completely different order who don't even wear habits. You can't tell, you know, whether they're the nuns or whether they're the gardeners. They're running to the store. They kind of do the shopping for the nuns on the hill that are cloistered. So, and you know, are they thinking, you know, well, there's some really good nuns up on the hill, but and less good nuns, you know, that are shopping at Safeway. I don't think any of us would think that. So, thank you very much. May the merit of our sitting be directed towards the centerlessness and the infinity that is our life, being thou numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.
Surpassable.